Russian march against the war. And they had a real debate. Oh, it was fantastic, she recalled. Some people on social media wrote, "What has just happened on RBC? It has never happened before. It was a real program. They put forward real facts." Afterward, the Duma member called Zhanna's boss to complain. "You know," one of Zhanna's superiors told her, "we value you not as a political commentator, but as a financial markets commentator." Zhanna also reported on the diplomatic efforts of Western leaders. Barack Obama and Merkel and Hollande, they put a lot of effort into launching the effort for ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, she remembered reporting. One of her superiors called her once again to complain. And he asked me one question. "What about Putin? Do you realize how much effort Putin has put into trying to ensure peace in eastern Ukraine?" Her father advised her to ignore the pressure, saying that she shouldn't censor herself. At the time, he was preparing a report on the scale of Russia's involvement in Ukraine, which was being concealed from the Russian people. He was also helping to organize a protest march against the war. On February 27, 2015, Nemtsov was finishing preparations for the march. He went to dinner with his Ukrainian girlfriend, Anna Duritskaya. Around 11:30, they were walking home across the Bolshoi-Moskvoretsky Bridge, just a stone's throw from the Kremlin, the place where Nemtsov could once have credibly imagined himself serving as Russia's president. A man approached them from behind and fired several bullets into Nemtsov, hitting him in the head, heart, and stomach. No shots were fired at Duritskaya. One wonders whether Nemtsov even had a split second for a final thought to pass through his head, to wonder at how his own life had taken him so far from those early optimistic days when he was a young man, finding his voice at a moment of new beginnings for Russia. One more casualty of Putin's war. We demonstrated weakness, and the weak are beaten. 12. Democratic nationalism. Alexei Navalny has been a difficult adversary for Putin, in part because he's not the kind of Russian oppositionist who tells Americans what they want to hear. This became obvious as soon as I broached the subject of Ukraine, the country that, in some way, had precipitated everything from Russia's offensive against American democracy to Trump's first impeachment. "You cannot just give Crimea back," he told me. Navalny reminded me that his father was Ukrainian and his mother Russian, so he grew up spending time in both countries. He described childhood visits to his Ukrainian family after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when these visits were now to an independent country. "All through the 90s, we have a family argument, every dinner, every family gathering. We have this discussion, what is better, to preserve the Soviet Union or to be divided?" From the Ukrainian perspective, the answer was clear. "We were feeding you," he recalled his Ukrainian family telling him, since Ukraine was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. "Now we're independent and we're going to live much, much better." And this was kind of a central idea. Central to the forces that drove Ukrainians into the streets in the Orange Revolution in 2005 and onto the Maidan in 2014. Central to Ukraine's desire to draw closer to Europe, to join the European Union and NATO, to be more prosperous and free of Russian domination. That was the Ukrainian desire. From the Russian perspective, he said, the answer was also clear. "My mother, who is Russian, and I would say, give us Crimea and get the hell out of here," he recalled. Crimea is separated from mainland Ukraine and Russia, a peninsula that sticks out into the Black Sea. Its population is majority ethnic Russian, but the territory was shifted to Ukraine in the middle of the 20th century, part of the opaque Kremlin maneuvering of people and places designed to shore up their empire. "It was something deep inside every Russian, this understanding that the people in Crimea are Russian people, and without any real reason, they were given to Ukraine by Khrushchev." Despite his desire to keep Crimea, Navalny volunteered that he admired part of Obama's efforts to punish Putin for his annexation of the region. It wasn't what Obama was doing that he agreed with. It was how he carried himself on the world stage. With so much corruption circling around Ukraine, a place that has attracted all manner of Russian and American grifters and influence peddlers over the years, Obama seemed to just be a guy doing his job. Obama, when he started attacking Putin after Crimea and Ukraine, was an example for me, he said. Look, this is just an honest guy who was elected despite the fact that he was not rich. He was not connected. He was based in morality. Navalny clearly saw himself as someone who could become the president of his country while remaining honest. And this, in his view, meant not succumbing to the American position on Crimea. If I'm president, he said, I want to have something fair, a real, fair referendum, under independent observers. This, he contrasted with the rushed Potemkin referendum on Crimea's future that took place under the watch of Russian occupiers in 2014. Everyone will understand the results of this referendum, Navalny told me, anticipating, of course, that the result would be the same. Crimea would remain a part of Russia. Instead of criticizing the outcome of Putin's annexation of Crimea, Navalny focused on his motivation. Putin's fixation on the United States and an encroaching West. The constant warnings that Crimea would become a base for NATO ships or nuclear weapons. He's playing with something real, he said of Putin's Ukraine policy and broader political project. That sense of making amends for the humiliations of the past. But he's twisting it. He's perverting it. He's using the huge apparatus of propaganda and media to connect it to anti-American and anti-Western propaganda. To Navalny, approaching the issue of Crimea as a kind of geopolitical chess move diminished the very legitimacy that should buttress the union of Crimea with Russia. The fact that it was, to him, the right thing on the merits. It also bespoke a dangerous and self-destructive habit of Russian leaders to seek legitimacy at home through the pursuit of conquest or power abroad. These delusions about empire, he said. This is the most dangerous stuff for Russia, because it is why we were poor all the time. We were poor back in the Russian Empire with the Tsars, because they spent everything on empire. The same in the Soviet Union. Back in the USSR, we paid for Cuba. We paid for half of Africa. We paid for half of Asia. So we were poor. People don't have a color TV set in their apartment. They don't have any cars, even in the 80s. But we spend billions of dollars around the world. This imperial pursuit also allowed leaders to obscure their own corruption, distracting people from their own lot in life by offering a connection to some glory-seeking project. Putin's plan is the victory of Russia. Obama used to always tell me, in the longer game, a politician's strength can always become his weakness. This could become true for Putin and his total identification with the effort of once again projecting Russian strength abroad. Can't we spend our energy and the money of our country for ourselves? Navalny asked incredulously. Syria? He said, referring to Putin's intervention on behalf of Assad, which has been viewed as a strategic masterstroke by many Western analysts. It doesn't work at all. They wanted to repeat this trick from Crimea and the Ukraine war. But people are so annoyed. Syria? He repeated, as if the absurdity was self-evident. Why should we fight with these kinds of guys? We're restoring Aleppo? Repair some roads here! COVID-19 underscored this danger for Putin. As Navalny and I spoke, Russia's economy was spiraling into a deeper hole, even as Putin was ramming through constitutional reforms to allow himself to stay in power well into the 2030s. The pandemic itself was mismanaged, alternatively denied and attacked, responsibility delegated down to lower-level officials who were never empowered to do their jobs. Navalny complained about the shipment of vital medical supplies that Putin had sent to the United States and Western European countries early in the pandemic, as evidence of his increasing fixation on his geopolitical standing, a trolling czar. It's fun to be such a generous and noble person, to give a lot of presents to a lot of people. But if you're the poorest guy in the room, why are you giving stuff away to a rich guy? As usual, the thing that grated most on Navalny about Putin's rhetorical broadsides against the West was how they elided the extent to which everything Putin did was in service of power and profit. What is the best response to Putin? Navalny asked, clearly prepared to answer his own question. Look, if the West is so mean and bad and ugly, and there are gays everywhere, and the gay marriages, and morality is dying, which they are talking about all the time, my response is, I'm showing that these guys who are blaming the West have a palace somewhere in France. Showing people they are using their families and their nostalgia to live in a great country, make Russia great again. They're using it for their own personal good and personal profit. Navalny paused for effect. We can have a great country who can be a leader of Europe and one of the best countries in the world without that stuff. This was a potent message. These were the words of someone who wanted Russia to stand on its own two feet, but wanted the benefits to flow to ordinary Russians. He wasn't asking that the blunt force of American foreign policy come to his aid. He was more focused on the example that America set. For years, he told me, he had made an argument for what he calls democratic nationalism, the idea that the advanced democracies are richer because they have less corruption. Then, the argument was disproven. All those years, I was promoting that honesty is the best policy. Here's why Trump is a tragedy for us. All my literature is based on the idea that free elections are a system where a better guy becomes higher and a worse guy becomes lower. And now, what is the example? At the high point of this democracy, there is someone corrupted. That, more than anything else, is the return that Putin got on his investment in Trump. It's now very easy for Putin and for independent observers, just a guy who is reading the newspaper, to explain the idea that the Western world doesn't have any purpose, they don't have any idea what they're doing, and they're very much hypocrites and cynical. Navalny still believed that Putin's house of cards was going to collapse at some point, the same way the Tsars did, the same way that the Soviets did, perhaps the same way that the United States did under Trump. Putinism may have started from something pure, something visceral, that humiliation I saw on a night bus from Kaliningrad. But it had been corrupted, twisted, and rendered devoid of meaning, particularly as Putinism spread beyond Russia's borders. Perhaps Putin was marching himself over the precipice to be followed by acolytes like Orban, who were similarly out of ideas, out of justifications for their corrupt enterprises. When he's talking about national humiliation, Navalny said of Putin, he's blaming some other people. Outsiders. America. Europe. The West. It's an interesting phenomenon of Soros. Why Soros? Nowadays, no one knows who Soros is. I look at the far-right American and European propaganda, and Orban is talking about Soros all the time. It was a feeling I'd often had. A sense of tragicomic incredulity, looking at American right-wing media and conspiracy theories. With everything that's gone wrong in the world, why are we entering our fourth decade talking about this one man, George Soros? Because he offers a target that strikes the darkest chords of historical memory and nationalist reactionary politics. An immigrant, a financier, a globalist, a Jew. Navalny made no secret of his ambition. I can beat them, he said of Putin and his cabal, as a matter of fact. I understand that our movement, if we're registered as a party, in the first election, we would be in second place. And in the second election, we would beat them. To him, all of the sacrifices he has made would be worth little if they added up only to a lonely and futile pursuit of justice. This is where he contrasted himself with the Soviet-era dissidents, most of whom made their choice to oppose the regime without much hope that they would bring about actual political change. Navalny drew this contrast in ways that could sound similar to Putin, emphasizing that he was from the military towns outside Moscow, rather than from the city's cosmopolitan elite. The Soviet-era dissidents, he said, were people doing something right, without broad support, just some flashes of recognition from a handful of friends and foreign journalists. I have no idea how they did it, he told me. I am asking myself all the time. Instead, he goes out of his way to convey a different impression. I'm trying to preserve an organization with offices, to look like a real organization, with people who are sitting at their desks with their laptops, their MacBooks, not dissidents who are working underground. Even at 43, I've lived enough lifetimes in politics to see warning signs in every movement or personality that comes along. No one person has all the answers, particularly those who act as if they do. There are plenty of Russian liberals I know who see Navalny as a kind of Putin light, a nationalist with a personality-driven approach to politics. As a liberal, wary of nationalism, I caught myself at times trying too hard to project what I liked about Navalny onto him, while eliding the rougher edges that he made no effort to conceal. The comfortable assertion of a nationalism that, with an issue like Crimea, drifted into blood and soil territory. The leadership of an organization that appeared to be fueled by something of a cult of personality embedded in anti-corruption. But I've also lived enough lifetimes in politics to know that those things made him a more effective politician and viable leader of Russia, and to know that thinking Americans have any capacity to pick our ideal Russian leader, or American one for that matter, is a foolish impulse destined to lead to dashed expectations. We have to live in the world as it is. So why did I find Navalny so appealing? First, he at least put forward a nationalism that isn't corrupt, that tries to offer Russians a sense of dignity and national identity that isn't determined by a cabal of rich oligarchs skimming off the top. This is where an anti-corruption agenda leads inexorably to a set of affirmative principles with available models that suggest corruption need not be an inevitability, some unshakable bug in the Russian character. I have a very clear understanding of what kind of country we should build, Navalny told me, with that occasionally jarring certainty. I have a positive agenda. I do believe in market economy. I do believe in free media. I do believe in free elections. I do believe that Russia is not worse than Finland. We can live as a nice, rich country. Second, it was impossible not to admire the risks that Navalny was taking, which suggested that the pursuit of power alone could not have been the wellspring of his actions. He knew better than anyone the likelihood that the organization he had built would be smashed. At his 40 headquarters across Russia, he told me, there had been 300 searches, raids, people arrested, MacBooks confiscated. But he clearly priced that in, along with his own arrests, detentions, death threats, the shadow of physical harm. He trusted, maybe too much, in his own fame, in ways that also suggested a generosity toward those who lacked it. Honestly, he told me, I became sort of a famous guy. I'm in less danger than some regional activists. But there was another reason that I was drawn to him. That sense of righteous anger. We were speaking on FaceTime, each in some form of COVID quarantine. I had decamped for a few days to my mother-in-law's at the end of a tidy cul-de-sac in Huntington Beach, California. The houses were ringed with walls that concealed small swimming pools. The real estate appreciated steadily, given the proximity to the ocean. My children slept soundlessly in the adjacent room. During the days, quarantine was slightly easier here because they could ride their scooters on the empty suburban streets. This was about as far from Moscow as one could get. Navalny wore a white undershirt, just another guy in his 40s with kids, contending with the daily inconveniences of a pandemic and a world governed by people ill-prepared to deal with it. And the more we talked, the more I felt an unlikely sort of kinship with this son of the military towns. Part of it was the fact that we found ourselves on the wrong end of the same political trend in the world, even though the dangers he faced were exponentially greater. Part of it was the fact that we shared the same cynicism about what had gone wrong over the last 30 years, even as we'd taken very different paths to get there. But there was something more essential, a motivation that I recognized, something that was hard for me to put into words, but was present in nearly everything that Navalny said. "There are different types of people," Navalny told me. "Some people under the pressure, they are scared. And some people, they are more enraged." If I am honest with myself, my own motivations draw on rage. Even as I know that rage can at times distort your thinking and lead you down blind alleys. Even as I worked for a politician who was better at hope than anyone else these last 30 years. It was rage over 9/11 that propelled me down to Washington. It was rage over the Iraq War that propelled me into politics. The longer I served in government, the more it was rage over hypocrisy, over obstructionism, over meanness, over the endless gamesmanship, over unacknowledged racism that kept me going day after day when all my other sources of motivation had dissipated or run up against the limits of an uncooperative world. It was rage over the daily realities of Trump's America that had eaten away at me for the last several years. There it was, a little dose of rage, like a fix each morning with the news. The larger indignities of seeing things I'd worked on dismantled. Above all, rage over the toxic cloud of mediocrity and mendacity that encroached like an invisible force. From the moment I left the White House, I was often told by others with ambitions for future government service that I should be less angry, more circumspect in my comments. To assume a public role as an angry person was, in American politics, to define yourself as a less serious person, an identity that has become more dangerous for a Democrat to assume than a Republican, a partisan. To attack prominent people, even Republicans who had more than earned the attacks, was to deal yourself out of future positions that require the confirmation votes of Senate Republicans, or the acceptance of a Washington society that wants people to pretend to like each other, even, perhaps especially, when they don't. But I kept returning to rage, for reasons that I didn't really consider. Talking to Navalny, I felt comfortable that the reason I did so was to replenish my own motivation, the impetus and organizing principle for everything I was doing, including writing this book. Perhaps, in the end, it is futile. You look at the obvious corruption that shapes things around you, from who gets wealthy, to how the wealthy maintain power, to how the powerful design systems to enrich themselves and maintain power, to the ravaging impact that power can have on individual lives. The more you look, the more you see how the last 30 years of American hegemony has designed, wittingly or unwittingly, a system that others could easily manipulate, from big banks that are bailed out to Putin and his cronies moving vast sums of oil money around an infrastructure of shell companies, real estate interests, and opaque corporations facilitated by a poorly regulated global economy, to the service industry that profits by running interference for the wealthy and powerful, be it disinformation campaigns, private espionage, or the occasional act of violence. Seeing all that, you can decide, rationally, to dive into the system, as I had done in 2008, and accept its structural flaws while trying to make some discernible impact on it. Or you can step outside it and give voice to your rage at the injustice of it all. Having been spat out by the very system I had served, I had come to believe, rightly or wrongly, that it was in some intangible way irredeemable without a more profound overhaul, that the corruption of a man like Putin was inseparable from the broader corruption upon which the world ran. Navalny understood this. He sensed it intellectually. He felt it intuitively. Rage, after all, is an essential starting point for any revolution, even as success depends upon much more. Navalny was focused on the first step, and that was enough for me, even though my own lived experience suggested that success was far from likely. On August 20th, 2020, Alexei Navalny was poisoned and nearly killed. Coincidentally, That was the night that Obama was addressing the Democratic National Convention. The stakes were both lower and higher than those of his last four convention speeches. Lower in that he was no longer the front man. Higher because everything he had done or stood for was on the ballot. Over the past 4 years, I'd often experienced Obama's sense of rage over the direction of things. In private, he could be withering about Trump, though in public he was circumspect, continuing to model appropriate behavior, couching his warnings and recommendations for what needed to be done. But in his withdrawal from the arena, I recognized a different form of rage, the disappointment of someone watching a serious enterprise like the presidency be debased, the sense of betrayal that must come from watching an entire nation do something as unfathomably stupid as electing Donald Trump. And that night, he gave people a glimpse of the anger he felt. "They're hoping to make it as hard as possible for you to vote and to convince you that your vote doesn't matter," he said, emotion creeping into his voice. "That's how a democracy withers, until it's no democracy at all. We can't let that happen. Do not let them take away your power. Don't let them take away your democracy." For a moment, his delivery was poised upon the precipice of tears of frustration. Were we really going to give up the whole enterprise for this? For Donald J. Trump? A couple of hours later, scanning the reactions to his speech on Twitter, I noticed an item about Navalny. The initial reports suggested that his tea had been poisoned at an airport before he boarded a flight to Siberia. I saw the comment from his spokesman. He had taken ill on a plane and was in intensive care. I saw the alarming reports. He was in a coma. I saw the brazen hand of the Russian government. Videos that somehow quickly made it online of Navalny drinking tea in an airport. Videos that could come only from surveillance controlled by the Russian government. Like Boris Nemtsov's death or the foreign intervention in the 2016 American presidential election, the details of the story were murky and would change over time, but the gist of it was, again, clear. Putin was behind this. Watching this, thinking of all the various reasons that Putin may have had for doing it, the messages he intended to send to Navalny, other oppositionists, or the wider world, I knew that his motivations boiled down to one thing. He did it because he could. For the rest of the night, I felt the stakes of politics in the world all around me, like a heaviness in the air. I already knew there were people prepared to go to extraordinary lengths to perpetuate the corrupted state of things. This was yet another escalation of that dynamic. And while I knew my own government was not responsible, I also knew that it was led by someone who would stay silent about it. And he did. For a frequent traveler, there is nothing more mundane than getting a coffee or a tea in the minutes before entering the airport and boarding a plane. The action itself is so routine that I struggled that night to recall a distinct memory of any one of the hundreds of times that I had done this. I wondered how it had been for Navalny. What convergence of thirst, boredom, or fatigue had led him to decide that he'd grab a tea before his flight? Did it cross his mind, when eating and drinking in public spaces, that he was facing the same level of danger as when he heard the cell door clang shut behind him? When he began to feel the first stirrings of illness on board the plane, did he know immediately what it was? Of one thing, I felt certain. When he fell to the ground in pain, fading toward unconsciousness, that well of motivation was replenished. The undistilled rage that can arise only from pure injustice. The moments when the choices before people are cast in the most black and white version possible. Do we want to live in a world where innocent people are poisoned with impunity in airports? What kind of people would do that? And what dynamics enable them to get away with it? Sometimes people like Navalny are able to actually win power, to see things change. But perhaps even more powerfully, in their darkest moments, they show us the true nature of those they oppose. 13. A war without violence. The United States and Russia have been intertwined for a century, each shaping its own story in opposition to the other. The communist revolution that frightened capitalist America to its core. Wartime allies who then sorted the world into blocks made into competing exemplars for our respective ideologies and agendas. Cold War superpowers competing through proxy wars, neocolonial outposts, and the looming specter of nuclear war. After the Cold War, Russia, partly by American design, became more like America as it opened things up. But then, over the last decade, America, partly by Russian design, became more like Russia, as nationalism and conspiracy theorizing shaped our politics. Ironically, this Russian effort was made much easier by American-made social media and online culture. As I was leaving the White House, the reality of the scale of Russia's ambitions settled around me like Orban's comment about the fog settling on the landscape. With just 2 weeks left before Trump's inauguration, I sat in the Oval Office as the leaders of the U.S. intelligence community methodically walked us through Russia's sprawling and successful effort to shape the outcome of America's election. There was no doubt about these findings: the hacking and release of emails, the creation and dissemination of huge volumes of fake news, the smokescreen around how much of this effort was welcomed by or coordinated with the campaign of the incoming President of the United States of America. I remember Joe Biden looking incredulous as decades of assumptions about the guardrails around American politics were shown to have been upended. "Is this guy some kind of Russian asset?" he asked. The question hung unanswered in the air. Obama was more sanguine, even unsurprised, at how easy it had been for Putin. Perhaps because, unlike Biden or me, he was a black man who lacked illusions about the inevitable rightness of America. All Russia had done, he'd tell me again and again, was take advantage of the dark openings in American politics and culture, particularly online, where a vast industry of right-wing conspiracy theories had created a market for disinformation. We were an easy mark. Perhaps nothing in my lifetime symbolizes the triumph and spread of American-led globalization more than the internet and social media. American creations that somehow mirrored America's raucous commitment to free speech, unregulated capitalism, and unadulterated entrepreneurship, our unique capacity to connect the world. These forces had been unleashed on Russia in the 1990s, only to be repurposed and fired back into America, with a far more destructive result than any Soviet weapon ever achieved. We demonstrated weakness, and the weak are beaten. In 2017, I was forced for the first time to consider what it meant to be an American while living in a country that no longer made sense to me. As a child, I could take comfort in my Americanness by measuring it against the Soviet enemy. Even in the depths of the Iraq War, it seemed that my country had made a terrible mistake. Not that it was, in some essential way, a different place than I believed it to be. I now had to measure what I had thought it had meant to be American against an enemy within, an enemy that had been elevated to the highest office in the world. If I thought America represented diversity, Trump represented white supremacy. If I thought America was about hope for the future, Trump offered a crude longing for an ill-defined past. The worldview embedded in Putin's Beslan speech was now mirrored by the White House, which was dedicated to attacking the worldview embedded in Obama's 2004 convention speech. In my own, less risky way, I had become like the Russians I'd met over the years, a citizen struggling to hold on to my own identity as my country comes to stand for something else. I found my mind drawn back to a moment in early 2016, when I met with a group of Russian writers in a small room in the West Wing. It was one of those meetings that broke up the monotony of my days, that peculiar opportunity you have when serving at high levels of government, to choose to meet with a group of interesting people. In this case, it was a handful of writers sponsored by PEN, the organization that supports journalists and authors facing oppression around the world. I remember the familiar feeling of meeting with a group of people whom I could not possibly seem to help. Throughout the meeting, I was distracted by the fact that one of the women looked uncannily like my mother, which led my mind to wander and wonder just how far east my family's journey had begun, before the pogroms drove them across Poland and then to America. I asked the writers if they had any concerns about being affiliated with an American organization like PEN, or about meeting with people like me. No, they answered. It was their choice. What they wanted was not so much help as a simple opportunity to share their experience and perspective, which is, after all, a starting point for writing itself. One of the writers in that 2016 meeting was Maria Stepanova. Maria had come of age in the 90s and established herself as one of Russia's leading poets, in addition to being a novelist, a journalist, and the publisher of a crowdfunded website on news and culture. Like Zsabolcs Panyi in Hungary, a voice adapting to the spaces closing for discourse in her country. In the spring of 2020, I noticed an interview in which Maria spoke about the dark humor of being Russian, the realization that everyone had two identities, the one put forward in public and political spaces, and the private life lived behind closed doors. I thought she could help me make sense of the ways in which politics and identity in our two countries had blended in such a disorienting way. I asked Maria how she felt things had changed since the 1990s, that time of humiliation and hopefulness. The 90s were about the future, she said. Now everything is about the past, but not the actual historical past. Instead, she said, leaders like Putin, Orban, and Trump invented a past to suit their needs. There is an enchantment, an obsession with the past, but it is a fictional reality that doesn't have anything real. For Russia, she said, this transformation was completed with the 2014 annexation of Crimea and the return of the Russian Empire. Though it had been in motion for many years, the end results of years of smaller changes. In Maria's telling, Putin's first two terms as president, from 1999 to 2008, seem almost quaint when compared to his current stint. There were, of course, a rising standard of living and newly created wealth in oil-rich Russia. But there was also, she said, a degree of political freedom. You could be outspoken. Putin's creeping authoritarianism was still rooted in an orientation toward Europe and the United States, that age-old balancing act between East and West. It was all about following the Western way, she said, the Western mode. We want to belong to this family of nations. Russia may have become authoritarian again, but it was still pointed in the direction of nations that embodied a set of liberal values. Maria remembered feeling this way as recently as Dmitry Medvedev's inauguration in May 2008. On that day, she went out with a few colleagues from the website that she was editing. They were drinking coffee in a Moscow cafe, looking out at a pleasant courtyard. We were talking about the end of history, she said, that post-Cold War sense that the big questions had been resolved. Medvedev may have been Putin's lackey, but he was a Western character who wanted to be in decent standing in the Western clubs. During Medvedev's time in office, Obama had pursued a reset in relations with Russia, which led to cooperation on everything from nuclear arms control to trade. But there was also a vacuum. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Maria said, Russia had become a country that has forgotten what it means to have a history, a country that has fallen out of history. It had become, even more than Hungary, a country with a history filled with ghosts, the enormous suffering of the Soviet years, along with the sense of loss that accompanied the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was ripe for something to fill that vacuum. When Putin retook the presidency in 2012, Maria sensed a shift in him. From my perspective, this reflected the political calculation of a man who could no longer count on high oil prices to lubricate his corruption and consolidation of power. A man in need of legitimacy who turned to a convenient nationalism. But to Maria, Putin's shift also reflected a man who felt politically and personally wounded at home when his return to office was met by huge demonstrations led by the likes of Alexei Navalny. "These were the beneficiaries of his reign," Maria said, referring to the middle-class Muscovites who took to the streets. "People that he was identifying himself with, in a way." Perhaps Putin was like Russia, a man who felt himself falling out of history. Perhaps the cold, corrupt logic of power was not his sole source of motivation. To a man like Putin, falling out of history can engender its own rage. After his re-election, Putin gave a speech to an enormous crowd in Moscow, in which he quoted the great Russian poet, Mikhail Lermontov. In one of Lermontov's most famous poems, he wrote about the Napoleonic Wars, the first of two crises when Russians put aside their differences to repel an enemy at the gates. "We shall die before Moscow, as died our brothers. To die we swore, and our oath of fealty kept on the field of Borodino." When Putin read these lines, Maria recalled, he had tears in his eyes. Perhaps to Putin, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the ensuing tide of globalization represented another advance on Moscow, embodied in those 2011 protests led by Western-oriented Muscovites. In Ukraine, Putin rejoined history, the history that has dominated most of humanity's time on the planet, when nations fought wars over territory and reconquered places that had been taken away. The same understanding of history that illuminated Orbán's rhetoric about avenging lost lands, albeit without the military power. Blood and soil. Of course, Putin framed that conquest as necessary to stop another enemy at the gates of Moscow. Like everyone else I talked to, Maria noticed the omnipresence of a virulent patriotism inseparable from the person of Putin. But she also noticed a broader effort to reshape the consciousness of the nation. "I noticed a difference in the amount of violence around you," she said, "on television, social networks, etc. It is a violence you feel in the air, but the level of actual violence was quite low." Compared to the battles of Russia's past, the actual fighting in eastern Ukraine was a small endeavor affecting mainly the people there and the few thousand Russians sent furtively across Ukraine's borders. But there was something brutal and infectious about the propaganda that went along with it. I noticed it at the time. In memes that anticipated American conspiracy theories like QAnon, Russia's enemies were cast as pedophiles, sexual deviants, and diabolical criminals. This ability to manipulate and mobilize the national psyche, while keeping the stakes relatively low, represented a breakthrough for Putin, making easy use of America's unregulated and sensationalizing social media networks. "People are happy to be violent in the social networks," Maria said. "In that space, there has been rhetorical violence in Russia for the last 10 years, through the discourse of hate on social networks." I thought of my own daily experience of social media, the emotions that could be stirred by a single tweet, the reduction of discourse to a set of characters that could trigger someone in response, the endless online battle that can have no winner, but that seems to carry with it the highest possible stakes. This is our most prevalent experience of how politics meets culture today, the ceaseless immersion in social media and how they shape our perception of ourselves, our countries, and the world at large. Ironically, a space with no borders in which we try to assert what our nations mean. Neither Putin nor Orbán nor Trump created this reality. It was simply available to them. "They didn't invent it," she said, "but they are riding this wave, which travels a short distance. They are unable to build things, so they destroy things." This includes the very concept of objective reality and expertise upon which national decisions are supposed to be based. Given that the majority of culture has migrated online, someone like Putin doesn't have to suppress ideas so much as he needs only to overwhelm them with, to use the American jargon, content. To do this, Putin can count on trolls of the Russian state in what Maria called voluntary supporters, the countless online profiles who can also be counted upon to fuel messages of hate and nationalism. They are just aiding a feeling of instability. People are living in bubbles, and they're filtering the information that comes in. And they are experiencing the whole world of contradictory images that are in constant struggle with each other. That leaves you dizzy, unable to form a political vision or cultural identity, while endlessly distracted. Listening to Maria, I found it impossible to distinguish between Russia and America. You don't feel any sort of ground under your feet. The world is becoming terrifyingly flexible. Just as Sandor Lederer spoke of the unresolved history of Nazism and communism in post-Cold War Hungary, Maria observed the discourse was now tracking something in the unconscious from the dystopia of the 20th century. For Russia, that included everything from Stalin's purges to their war in Afghanistan to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Even the violence of Chechnya, the terrorism of the early 2000s, the murdered children of Beslan, still lingered. Whether it was out of conviction, for political convenience, or, more likely, some mix of both, Putin knew how to make Russians feel that they were re-entering history. The assassination of Boris Nemtsov and poisoning of Alexei Navalny can be seen as an extension of that trauma. Actions that keep history alive. On America's election day in 2016, Maria was in New York with friends and went out to a bar where people were buying one another drinks in anticipation of Hillary Clinton's victory. By the end of the night, everything had changed. "I didn't recognize this country I love," Maria said. "When it comes to Russia, one is cautious enough to predict the worst. America was supposed to be different." This isn't a feeling that has gone away simply because Trump has been voted out. Time and again, I encountered the stark reassessment of people abroad. It wasn't just the fact that Donald Trump was president that caused the reassessment of America around the world. It was the fact that American voters elected him in the first place, and therefore could do something that reckless again. Maria said the experience of the last few years had flipped the dynamic that I'd first encountered when I met her in 2016. When traveling abroad, she said, people often asked her, "What can we do to help you?" I myself had been one of those people. "I found this endearing and encouraging," she said. "There is nothing one can do to help Russia, but when one can think the situation can be helped, it gives you a certain kind of optimism." Maria knew that things had changed when she faced an audience shortly after the 2016 election, and an American asked her if she had any advice that could help Americans. I told Maria that I was asking her the same question. I had my own views about social media, about the need for regulation to slow the spread of disinformation and make companies liable for hateful content on their platforms. But how could we overcome the more fundamental crisis of identity that made all of this hate so alluring in the first place? The seeming breakdown of order that had been steadily progressing over the last 30 years. Maria volunteered that if she had the opportunity to vote for Navalny for mayor of Moscow again, she would do so. But while his single-minded focus on corruption represented a needed change, she did not think it was sufficient. Instead, she said, a more radical shift had to take place. To her, this was the other side of the coin from Navalny's interest in upending a corrupt cabal. The simple notion that politics and government had to be rooted in truth. People are yearning for a sense of truth, for a certain sense of reality that is always being distorted. People are asking for something that is based on an ethical frame. The danger of the other path is catastrophe. The history that Putin had re-entered is the older kind, which inevitably leads nations down rivers to the heart of darkness, born on the currents that gave rise to fascism and communism, Hitler and Stalin, two men who had caused the death of tens of millions of Russians. When history appeared to come to an end at the conclusion of the Cold War, the specter of another world war was lifted, and with it some of the sense of drama that Putin had tapped into. And while wars fought online were not often tied to actual violence, a dizzying array of narratives online recirculated those old 20th century forces in new packaging. In particular, a creeping and sometimes casual fascism that suited Putin and had reshaped the American right wing. As a Russian, Maria knew how this kind of history can hurt people in ways that Americans too often do not. Every Russian had been touched by World War II. Every Russian family had suffered in some way through the Soviet times. This was the main thing she had to tell us Americans, I realized, this warning. She feels the return of history. "I'm afraid of some catastrophe that is going to happen," she said, referring to her mindset these last few years. "I feel it in my bones. I am sharing this with my compatriots. There is going to be a new war, World War III, or the gulags, or the trials." What she hadn't anticipated, she said, was a pandemic. Talking to her at the height of lockdown, with the death toll in the United States soaring toward 200,000, and my own life upended along with everyone else's, I understood what she was saying, that we could all be re-entering history through some other door, one that might ultimately lead somewhere better than war. We are all confronted with this virus. We even used the language of war in describing our efforts to defeat it. But there was something different about this moment when what was most obviously required was expertise and common effort. "It is a war without an enemy," she said, "without the language of hate or the necessity to fight." Perhaps, she suggested, this could reawaken respect for truth and expertise. Perhaps it could highlight the danger of people living inside their own distorted narratives. Perhaps it could finally drive home the lesson that we are living in a world in which danger, a pandemic now, climate change later, reveals the absurdity of hardening borders and clinging to revanchist nationalism. Maria knew as well as anyone that the opposite could also happen. The disorder unleashed by the pandemic will surely take years to unfold, just as it took a decade for the consequences of the financial crisis to become apparent. But to Maria, at least, there was the potential for an inflection point that could steer things in a different direction, the hidden hand of history. "It gives me hope," she said, "because it is something new, something global." Vladimir Putin has done his part to avenge the humiliations that came with the end of the Cold War. Historians will debate how much America might have instigated some of this retribution or might have done things differently to forestall it. How complicit were we in the chaotic privatization and transition to capitalism in the 1990s, which created a new class of oligarchs while enraging the Russian public? Were we too triumphalist in our foreign policy, lording it over the defeated Russians through the expansion of NATO, the push to include former Soviet republics like Georgia and Ukraine, which Putin subsequently invaded? Were we too casually belligerent in our hegemony, meddling in the affairs of other countries and trying to engineer their politics until there was, inevitably, a backlash in which an adversary did the same to us? Was Obama too timid in the face of Putin's increasing belligerence in Ukraine and Syria, and capable of finding a formula to push back against an adversary who'd gone on offense? These debates are important, but they make up only part of the picture. The more I consider the ways in which the stories of America and Russia have been intertwined, the more I realize that our bigger failures lay in choices made by Americans without Russia in mind. After the end of the Cold War, we often failed to elevate America's purpose in the world above the methodical expansion of global markets, allowing America to become tethered to the dislocations and inequality produced by late-stage capitalism. Our embrace of a global war on terror created a basis for leaders like Putin to securitize their own grip on power, while the invasion of Iraq introduced a destabilizing new normal to global politics. Laws and norms were for the weak, and the strong could do anything they wanted, even invade and occupy a foreign country on a false pretense. We embraced new technologies and promoted their spread, without thinking through how they could be used to undermine democracy and the objective reality required for an informed citizenry to make decisions. With the cloud of nuclear apocalypse lifted, our own political culture descended into triviality and racialized grievance, opening the door to both Donald Trump and the online Russian cavalry that came to his assistance. We became a nation at war with an invisible enemy, only it wasn't a pandemic or climate change. It was a war with ourselves, a war that took us out of history and rendered us a diminished giant, humiliated by our embrace of incompetent authoritarianism. But what has Putin really accomplished? Beyond enriching himself and his associates, and claiming some small pieces of the former Soviet Union for Russia, he has proved to be far more adept at destroying than at building. Russia has been economically and socially weakened, enthralled with an ideal of its own past, and incapable of offering the world a model for the future beyond a cautionary tale about the vagaries of corruption and vindictive nationalism. This great nation that gave the world Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, that once saved Europe from fascism and sent the first satellite into space, now exports a toxic stew of conspiracy theories and disinformation that will make as little sense to people in the future as it does to anyone living in reality today. Even in the games of geopolitical chess that Putin relishes and sometimes excels at with his instinct to attack, he has allowed himself to become a junior partner to a Chinese Communist Party that appears much more confident in the model that it is building. At home, the bullets and poison dispensed on his behalf only illuminate the fears of a ruler who lacks confidence in the sustainability of his own project. Whether he is defeated by a Navalny or clings to power for as long as he wants, Putin, at some point, will be gone. That much is certain. What will be his legacy? In my final trip before the first COVID lockdown, I met with Congressman Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee in Washington. He'd recently completed the noble and ultimately incomplete ordeal of the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump, which also amounted to an autopsy of what Russia had done to America and what we had done to ourselves. I'd come to know Adam well when I was in government, and he was a less prominent congressman. He was thoughtful, earnest, and soft-spoken, the rare congressman who would spend an hour with you just because he was curious about something, not because he wanted anything. The normally reserved man I'd come to know had become almost unrecognizably passionate, even desperate at times, a person articulating what it's like to feel the ground evaporating beneath your feet, trying to recapture a sense of objective reality through the assertion of fact after fact after fact. I wanted to know what he'd taken away from it all. When we met in his office, he was trailed by a plainclothes security detail, a precaution, I was told, because of the volume of death threats he received from the hate-filled corners of our online culture. One more front in a ceaseless war. We trundled down to the basement of a House office building and got coffee from Dunkin' Donuts. Schiff politely asked a woman if we could sit at the other end of her table. She nodded, annoyed, over something she was reading. I asked Adam what he thought he'd learned about Russia. He said that Putin seemed to have little ideology beyond a fierce Russian nationalism, a will to power and profit, and a desire to harm the United States. Putin has a perception that the best way to aggrandize Russia, he said, is pulling down the United States. But as much as we could critique Putin's intentions, the results were impossible to ignore. Adam seemed intent on not losing his shock at the course that events had taken, though he had also come to understand how much Americans had also made Putin's task easier. He seemed to have integrated the incredulity that I'd seen on Biden's face in the Oval Office with Obama's colder realization that we turned ourselves into an easy mark. Both, after all, were correct responses. "Can you imagine?" Adam asked, as if still trying to wrap his mind around Putin's success. "In his wildest dreams, that the President of the United States would parrot his talking points? It was the intelligence coup of the century." With the passage of time, it was less important to deconstruct the tactics of this intelligence coup, the misadventures of Russian intelligence agents and Trump associates, the hacking of emails whose contents seemed sensational at the time and feel meaningless today, the disinformation that could feel like a drop in the ocean of our own toxic national discourse. We were, Adam said, ripe for exploitation. He checked his watch. Soon he would have to attend a memorial event for Elijah Cummings, the black congressman from Baltimore who had recently passed away after being accused by Trump of representing a rat-infested district, the kind of thinly veiled racism easily exploited by Putin and his army of trolls. "Putin wants to weaken Western societies," Adam said. "He knows the fault lines well. He knows how to manipulate them on social media. It's cheap and deniable. The violence, as Maria had said, without the actual violence." The worry, Adam said, is that Russia is exporting these methodologies, causing them to mushroom across the United States and around the world. The counter-revolution gone viral. Still, Russia itself was not likely to be the beneficiary for the same reasons that Navalny had seized upon. The corruption that is only about the perpetuation of wealth and power for a particular group of people in a particular time. Putin runs the government like a Ponzi scheme, and eventually, Ponzi schemes implode. The more ominous danger, Adam said, came from China. Putin's Russia is the threat of a wounded animal. China is the threat of a growing, strengthening, burgeoning power. It was a power that had the capacity to do more than tear things down, the stopgap nationalism of a Putin or Orban. Russia could destroy. China could build. So perhaps, after Putin tore down pieces of the post-Cold War Western world, it was China that would replace the old order, with consequences for our politics, culture, and identity for a century to come. In large part, because of technology. If Russia represented the vengeance extracted from fights rooted in the past, China represented the future coming into view. "The Chinese have been more risk-averse to date," Adam said. "But they have massive troves of data that can be used to build a surveillance world that Orwell doesn't do justice to." Part 3. The Chinese Dream. Passivity is fatal to us. Our goal is to make the enemy passive. Mao Zedong. 14. Meet the new boss. I had just drifted to sleep in my Shanghai hotel room when the landline woke me with a persistent ring. I mumbled hello and a polite voice said, "Mr. Rhodes, the Vice Foreign Minister is here to see you," as if it were the most normal thing in the world. It took me a moment to get my bearings. I was no longer a government official. The clock by the bed told me it was around 10. It was late 2017, and I was traveling with Barack Obama, now a former president of the United States. I got up, put on some clothes, and arranged a couple of chairs at the foot of the bed. When I answered the knock on the door, I was surprised to find two men standing there. One was the Vice Foreign Minister with responsibility for North America, a younger guy whom I recognized from times when we'd both been in enormous bilateral meetings with rows of silent staff flanking our bosses. He spoke in meticulous English with the faint trace of a British accent, vestiges of the 19th century British Empire that became America's 20th century hegemony, the expectation that Americans could communicate in our own language, even in uncomfortable circumstances. The other man didn't say a word. We took our seats and the Vice Foreign Minister plowed into a presentation. President Xi and the Chinese people, he said, appreciated the positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relationship that President Obama had forged in office. There were many achievements to be proud of, he asserted. I almost enjoyed the familiarity of the exchange, still wondering why we were there. "I understand you're going on to India next," he said. "Yes," I replied, "to Delhi," as if that offered some necessary clarity. I noticed the other man begin to watch intently. "We understand," the Vice Foreign Minister continued, "that President Obama is considering a meeting with the leader of the Tibetan separatist movement." He was referring, in the way that Chinese officials do, to the Dalai Lama. And with that, he got to the point. It would be a personal insult to Chinese people and Xi Jinping, he said, if the meeting took place so soon after Obama had been welcomed in China. speaking in the diplomatic code that had become second nature in government. I said that we very much appreciated their feelings on the matter, and President Obama would make his own decisions about whom to meet. It was a typical way of saying that we'd meet with the Dalai Lama without coming out and saying it. In this way, in a kind of metaphor for how U.S.-China relations have been managed over the decades, we could say offensive things to each other without being offensive. At the end of the exchange, everyone seemed satisfied, and I was left alone. Closing the door, I thought, we had not announced a meeting with the Dalai Lama. I had only recently been put in email contact with the Dalai Lama's representatives after they learned of Obama's trip to India, where the Dalai Lama has lived in exile for well over a half century. Despite the recency of my government service and my famous boss in a nearby suite, my guest had no problem letting me know they were monitoring my communications. With my hope of any jet-lagged sleep ruined, I walked outside to get some air. The hotel was right next to the Bund, the riverfront area that offers a breathtaking view of Shanghai's multicolored skyline. Shades of pink, purple, yellow, and blue beamed off a set of futuristic towers and glistened in the darkened water below. Pockets of tourists all stood with their backs to this image of postmodernity, taking selfies, their phones grasped in sticks held aloft in the night air. Here was the blend of politics, culture, and economics that America had created. Skyscrapers, technology, and social media that allowed someone to create an idealized version of their own existence, transformed into a demonstration of Chinese ascendance, from the British to the American to the 21st century's empire. To someone from the Chinese countryside, or a similarly developing nation, the scene must have seemed an awesome and improbable achievement. The construction of this almost entirely new city on top of its old colonial center, indicating that the West's supremacy need not be exclusive or indefinite. The wealth on display was tied to indisputable progress that had lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, economic growth that put food in stomachs and roofs over heads, an achievement of American-led globalization and the Chinese Communist Party, which had made the decision to plug into it. But there was something soulless about the scene and what it represented. To me, an American, it seemed to strip the century-long achievement of the American superpower of meaning. American wealth begetting wealth in other places, exporting inequality. The individual reduced to pursuing an image to post on social media that millions of other people have already posted. Those same technologies offering a totalitarian government or faceless corporation access to limitless troves of data indicate our political preferences, commercial interests, and personal desires. Like a scientist in some laboratory, the Chinese Communist Party had taken American globalization and separated out any pretense of individual liberty, preserving the supply chains and movement of people and capital, but carefully removing the freedoms. In their place was the promise of wealth, security, and pride in national greatness, or at least the feeling of empowerment that might come with proximity to wealth, security, and national greatness. I hit the button on my iPhone screen that froze an image of the Bund and uploaded it to Instagram. I was an American in a world that America had made in its own image, a world that now felt oddly foreign in its familiarity. I was an individual who felt unmoored amid the forces shaping the world, my own identity as incidental as a flicker of light in the panorama that reflected off the water. I was a political exile of sorts, cast among the figures of the past who objected to the general direction of events, clinging to pride in the fact that I'd soon meet with a Tibetan Buddhist who was almost sure to die in a foreign land. I turned to walk the few paces back to the hotel, taking momentary solace in the likes that began to register on the screen of my phone, like an addict being given tiny doses of an opioid by some giant unseen beast. During that trip to Shanghai, Obama had spoken to an organization named the Global Alliance of Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises, SMEs. It's one of those rites of passage for a post-presidency. You can't really make a normal living, So you fly around the world speaking to groups like this. The name itself suggested a borderless and opaque form of capitalism. The event had been curiously